Now, this is the way we normally start the show. What's happening? You want me to say it or don't say it? Don't say it? Okay. Oh, can we get some help bringing the food in?
If you had been in New Orleans on this particular October evening and lucky enough to have gotten the call, you would have jumped in your car and driven to a stretch of Claiborne Avenue lined with gas stations and fast food restaurants. You would have parked on a side street, or maybe in a church lot, and walked to a bar called The Place to Be. A bouncer, watching you through a one-way mirror, would have turned a deadbolt and let you in.
Now, I know everybody in here loves the blues, right? I know everybody loves the blues, right? Because you get the blues in the morning. Sometimes you get it in the noontime. We call that lunch. And when you be hungry and you don't have no food, you gotta get the blues. And then you got that supper time.
The Place to Be is a beige, double shotgun building at the bottom of a highway exit ramp. Inside, it feels like a family rec room. The ceilings are low. The bar is decked in Christmas lights. In back, a big screen TV shows highlights from today's Saints game. The room smells of ribs, red beans, and rice, dished out free to patrons on game days. And the music? Well, it sounds like this. Chances are you've never heard of The Place to Be. It doesn't advertise. It doesn't send its schedule to radio stations. It doesn't even have a regular live music schedule. But do not underestimate the talent here on this Sunday evening. On trombone and vocals is Doc Lewis, who used to play with James Brown. Today, he's celebrating his birthday, and well-wishers have pinned dollar bills to his shirt, an old Louisiana tradition. In between songs, Lewis keeps up a lively banter with the audience.
You ever hear them people talk, they partied a whole month? Don't believe them. Don't believe them. You can't stay drunk that long. Come on, I partied a whole month on my birthday. Y'all be lying. Y'all can't party that much.
Yes, we do.
Okay, answer this question then. Answer this question. The birthday party is on now, can't you tell?
Joining Doc Lewis is an impressive crew. It includes Robert B.J. Harvey, the bass guitarist for Irma Thomas, Miyumi Shira, a drummer from Tokyo, and guitarist John T. Lewis, a veteran of the city's R&B clubs. Customers dance at the tables, throw their heads back in laughter, and lean over to whisper requests. Over the next hour, we'll be visiting bars like this one, remnants of a once-flourishing culture of neighborhood blues and R&B joints. A mainstay of the Crescent City music scene, they are struggling now, like much of New Orleans. From the recession, from the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and potentially from the ripples of the BP oil spill. Clubs like these provide sustenance for New Orleans musicians. And a link to its celebrated past. We'll learn more about this resilient, often hidden world during this radio special, Crescent City Blues. I'm Richard Ziegler. New Orleans is best known for its jazz. but it also has a lively blues and rhythm and blues scene that stretches back for more than half a century. The city produced such greats as Professor Longhair, Irma Thomas, and Fats Domino. Its recording studios pioneered a distinctive R&B sound from the 40s through the 60s. And its nightlife was legendary. Here's George Green, author of Say Goodbye to Old New Orleans.
Because there was a saying that there's a club on every corner and a church in the middle of every block. They had a million clubs. They're little bitty clubs. Some clubs had two tables, a bar with two stools, little bitty place. One dude had a little shed, a garage in his back of his house. He made a club out of it. It was about three-fourths of a regular garage. It was just a place. But him and his friends would drink. He had a license and everything. That was it. You go to places on Mondays, and they may be selling, have red beans and rice and smoked sauce over here. They may have fried chicken over here. They may have a fish and potato salad over here. They may have meatballs and spaghetti. All the clubs had a Blue Monday where they had the food for the customers. And it was Blue Monday. But that was every Monday somewhere. I said, where are you going? I said, I'm going back by the hurricane. But what they got fried chicken back there. Okay, but I'm going out front by the shadow. What happened? Oh, they got red beans and rice. Right? That was it. Tuesday was a layout. Everybody was layout, trying to get together. Wednesday, they start slow. Thursday's okay. Friday night, we were full steam. Saturday's New Year's Eve, and it's on.
For John T. Lewis, a former appliance repairman who now plays music full-time, the memory of those clubs still lingers.
We used to play at places like Tony's Green Room, you know, smoke-filled room, you know what I mean? You walk in there, man, and you know it's going to be great because of the excitement. You know, I would actually look for a particular type of place that had a certain smell. Spittoons and liquor, old spilled liquor on the bar and beer and cigars and smoke and stuff is the aroma of what's about to happen.
Some of these bars were neighborhoods that have since fallen victim to urban blight. Places like Dryad Street in Central City. Ernie Vincent, who has played blues, funk, and R&B since the 1960s, recalls Dryad's in its heyday.
Nobody from uptown would have to go on Canal Street because Dryad Street had everything. Dryad Street was similar to magazine today. They had markets, they had shops, they had clothing stores, they had tailors, they had pawn shops, they had repair services, they had everything. I mean, you didn't have to, if you needed to do any shopping, front of your stores, all that was on Dryad Street.
And Dryad Street had music. One of the legends of the New Orleans rhythm and blues scene is Deacon John Moore, who played on hundreds of recordings during the 1950s and 60s. Deacon John spent decades working the Crescent City bar scene, including the clubs on Dryad Street.
Back home, T98 to the land of the beautiful queens. I'm going back home to my baby. I'm going back to New Orleans. Gonna see Nene, my pa Rain, Cousin, and my ma and pa. Gonna plant my feet on Rampart Street and be there for the Mardi Gras. I've been to Cuba, South America way. I've been to Euro, Mexico is okay. Over in France, the chicks are really fine. I get my kicks below the Mason-Dixon line. Going back home, T98, nevermore will I roam. Gonna get my fill of gumbo filet, cause New Orleans is my home.
They were segregated, you know. They had all black clientele, and some of them they had middle-class people and low-class people, and pimps and whores and prostitutes, all that kind. But I was oblivious to all that because I was so into the music, you know. But it's like at the Sportsman's Lounge on Dryad Street. Well, that was a place, you know, where most of the working class people hung out, you know. They'd get off work and they'd come down to the lounge and they usually had a room in the back where they'd gamble. They'd playing cards and shooting dice, and the club owner would cash their checks, you know. And once he cashed that check, well, let's get there and spend money, you know, and the band started playing, they'd buying drinks, and people were dancing and partying and gambling going on, and it was like a fun place to be, you know. I was in a sportsman ball one time on Dry Street, and they had a raid, and the police came in there, and they started arresting people, you know, for possession of firearms and stuff, and everybody started throwing all their knives in my guitar case. So I was kind of shaking, said, oh, Lord, if my mama knew where I was, now and I go to jail, but I'm gonna be in big trouble, man. But fortunately, that never happened, you know, but I did play in some bars where the police raided the place, and they took a lot of people to jail, but they never messed with the band. There were other clubs, you know, like the Dewdrop. Well, they catered to a little more upscale clientele, you know, because they had a cover charge and a floor show. You know, like Dewdrop was like the pinnacle of the black entertainment clubs because it was like a one-stop place. They had a restaurant, hotel, barbershop, nightclub complex, you know, like a magnet for the traveling bands because Frank Pena, the club owner, he could get bands that were kind of like stranded on the road and give them a job and let them have a place to stay until they were up well enough to get back on their feet. Like if a gate got canceled out or something, well, Frank would get these guys, you know. And a lot of them were big name stars who didn't have a big name at the time. You know, like Ray Charles used to play over there.
You'll only be fighting a losing battle, baby. But you'll have so much fun trying to win. I watch the sun when it rises until it fades away. I have nothing but sleepless nights, and all I have is endless days. I ask my baby, should I go away?
The Dewdrop had the reputation of being like the premier, the best one, because he would offer a floor show. He would have like an exotic dancer, or you have a comedian, a ventriloquist, and then he'd have the house band and come on, and he'd have female impersonators. The most famous one was Patsy Baldea, who was the MC at the club. Patsy would be dressed up as a woman, and she'd have like a big gown on with can-can slips and a cigarette holder, and she'd have big long white gloves on with a great big hat and just dressed to the nines with high heels and stockings. And she would just greet the club patrons and say, welcome to the Dewdrop, darlings. This is your host with the most. And drink hearty and stick with your party. Say, tonight we have the exciting Mr. Eddie Bohr. Trying to be proper. His name was Eddie Bohr, but she said, Eddie Bohr. And then she would sing a song. Patsy would sing something like All of Me. She'd say, all of me, why not take all of me? And at the end she said, you took the best. And then she'd pick up her dress and say, now come on and get the rest. And everybody would just fall out on the floor and say, why not take all of me? Da 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 da.
The Dewdrop offered a stage to Louisiana bluesmen like Earl King and Guitar Slim, and national celebrities like Little Richard. But it closed in the 70s, and today the building is weathered and padlocked. In many places, it's covered with nothing but plywood. Six blocks away, on Dryad Street, inside a bar called Guitar Joe's House of Blues, several older musicians sit reminiscing about those days. They include the bar's owner, Guitar Joe Daniels, and Ken Jones, who still MCs at neighborhood clubs. Asking questions is guitarist John T. Lewis.
The Dewdrop Inn, what was y'all experience at the Dewdrop?
I just lived there, man.
We lived there.
Yeah, $7 a week.
Guitar Joe lived there. You lived at the
Dewdrop
Inn. The Dewdrop Inn.
Me?
At Mr. Pena's place,
yeah,
right?
Frank Banyard.
Earl King, Guitar Slam. All musicians mostly was living there.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. It was cheap. Cheap rent. You could buy red beans and rice, you could feed yourself for 35 cents.
What?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What year this was? We're talking about?
That was in 57. The 50s.
Oh, it was great, man. It was. All the music, Larry Donnell, Joe Turner, Earl King, Guitar Slam.
Nobody slept because they figured they'd miss something.
Today, small clubs like Guitar Joe's are trying to preserve New Orleans blues and R&B legacy, but they're struggling to hold on. More on that when we return with this radio special, Crescent City Blues. I'm Richard Ziegler.
Knocking on my front door. Hip shaking, mama was rocking and reeling sore. But I didn't want to do it. No, no, I didn't want to do it. No, no, I didn't want to do it. But she moves me so. She called me a loving daddy, held me oh so tight. Squeeze and tease and thrill me, born all through the night. But I didn't want to do it. No, no, I didn't want to do it. No, no, I tried not to do it. But she sends me so.
I'm Richard Ziegler. You're listening to Crescent City Blues. It's part of a series called Still Singing the Blues. You can learn more at our website, stillsingingtheblues.org.
I know a little bluebird. I sure wish she would sing for me. I know a little bluebird.
On a Sunday night in January, a few dozen regulars have gathered at the Young at Heart Club in New Orleans' Pigeontown District. They have piled into the brown leatherette booths that line the knotty pine walls. Red tinsel hangs everywhere, along with leftover birthday decorations. Strung up in bubble letters are the words, Disco Party. The bar's owner, Odie Rayford, lays out a home-cooked buffet. The customers shout encouragement to the band, and particularly to vocalist Tommy Singleton. He's an elegant man, wearing a gray satin shirt, matching tie, and Omberg hat with a feather tucked into the side. Even though he has never recorded, he's been a musician for more than half a century.
Mother and father, they were real religious people. We went to, they made me go to church every Sunday. Then they made me sing in the choir. You know, I hated that. I hated singing in the choir because I was very shy. And it took me a long time before I can really sing and get out that shyness. I was very, very shy, man. But I always could sing. My father, he was a truck driver. So he wouldn't be home as much as he needed to be home, you know. Because my mother passed when I was like about 8 years old. So from there, I was in a foster home, something like that. Then I made a very unfortunate mistake. Got married at 18. So when I got married, that cut my singing short because I had to try to find me a job and everything like that. So I didn't really do too much singing then.
In the early 1970s, Singleton began singing again in earnest. One of his first bands was called the Living Dead Review.
How this started was, we were just sitting around like we just sitting around now. This guy named Morris Bates, he just said, man, he's, cause he said it would be a good idea, because at the time Otis Redding had just passed. And he was just sitting around. He said, man, this would be a good idea if we can get somebody to do an Otis Redding thing, like coming out the casket. He was going to buy a casket. This was back in like 76. The next thing we saw him drove up with a hearse and called us over to the hearse. And they had a casket that they had painted it red, white, and blue. The bicentennial year. So we got a guy named Robert Williams to do the Otis Redding. We dressed up in tux, and we would roll him in and put the casket in, and he would be singing. And, you know, we have the top down, put the mic in the casket, and he would start singing. And, you know, you could hear him, but you couldn't see him. And then after a while, he would raise up out of the casket and sing.
Singleton spent many years singing rhythm and blues with Ernie Vincent in the Top Notes. He traveled once with the band to Mexico, but most of the time he stayed closer to home, holding down day jobs and singing at night.
I've just been a workaholic all my life. So I was working at a restaurant, doing washing dishes, working on a milk truck, cutting grass, I tried to be a cook. I don't think the restaurant owner had enough patience with me. After I burnt up a few things, you know, he decided I wasn't a cook. So I had to find something else to do, truck driving. I still work part-time. I drive a truck, for a company called P&J Oyster Company.
A busy work schedule meant that Singleton could not develop a musical career that kept pace with his talents. He never recorded a CD, and without that, he couldn't get booked into casinos or large venues.
I've been searching to get that nice CD out there, man. I went to a few places to get, you know, to get work. That's the first thing they asked me, where is your CD, man? I mean, it doesn't have to be a CD that's burning up the chart, but you got to have a CD out there to show the people that you're a serious recording artist.
The places where Singleton has found work have been smaller clubs, whose owners appreciate his expressive voice, his flair for style, and the way he connects with audiences. Most of Singleton's gigs are far from the French Quarter, at places like Guitar Joe's House of Blues, where his wife Trina waited tables for 15 years. These clubs, patronized almost entirely by locals, are where Singleton feels most at home.
At Joe's been around so long, it's like a fixture in the neighborhood. And then you have the pool table, the guys come shoot pool. You know, they can just hang out and just talk and drink and everything. And nobody harasses them or anything. They can just have fun in these places. The place to be, you can go in the place to be any day. You're going to see a spade game. They'll be playing cards or sitting around watching some guys. Some will be sitting around watching TV and drinking and just having fun. You know, these players just have that homely atmosphere to them. And I think that's why people gravitate to these places.
But it's more than that, says Trina Singleton. These are places where a musician's wife might cook enough hearty food to feed the entire bar. Because that's just what you do in New Orleans. And there are places where the owners will keep their doors open, even during the thick of an economic downturn.
So I do whatever I can do, and I spend money, I cook food, I don't care who eat, because that's my thing. And I said, O.D., I love that about him, because I see that I never have seen no owner really strive that hard when they're not making no money to keep the band going. You know, because he could like, well, I'm not making any money. I can't afford to pay the band, but O.D. get around here and walk around him and make it. You know, he do whatever he can do to support this band, to keep the band playing and to keep us happy, the customers.
Coming up, a special guest at Young at Heart Club when we return with this radio special, Crescent City Blues. I'm Richard Ziegler. One night at Young at Heart Club, bluesman Ernie Vincent holds court, occasionally sending drinks to friends. Vincent, the leader of the Top Notes for 40 years, says he's just visiting as a customer, but the crowd insists he pick up a guitar, and of course he obliges. As Vincent and the band begin to play, it's easy to imagine him as a teenager, jamming at the fish fries held by his neighbors, Curly and Marie, every Friday night.
You'll smell fish cooking, and then Miss Marie will be fish cooking fish in the kitchen with that. That's next door. You'll see guys standing around drinking beer and little corn liquor and gambling. Curly would have a dice thing he put on the bed. He put, I think it was plywood, and he had uncovered it and made two little 2x4 railings on it. And the guys would be up there around it gambling. Now, there might be another room in the back. They got a little table. They playing catch or whatever back in there. I mean, it's just like a little ballroom. I mean, just like you would have, what they call it, when back in the days in the 20s, the red light deal and stuff like that. Corn liquor wasn't legal. Miss Marie's go once a week in the Mississippi and get it and bring it in. And the people come there strictly to get the corn liquor, get the white lightning. When they all get their head together, then Curly bring his guitar out and he start playing little Jimmy Reed stuff. And everybody was having fun. I was like, y'all looking at it, say, come on, Ernie, play something for me. And I get the guitar, and I'd be in the midst of all these older guys now. Basically, it was older guys. And I would try to play the Jimmy Reed stuff, and I started driving myself to make that work.
At one of those fish fries, Vincent met a drummer named Herlin Delpit, who was looking for a guitar player. The men began playing together, first in Louisiana, then in Mississippi. During those years, Vincent found a mentor named Poe Will, whom he calls the number one bluesman in Heidelberg, Mississippi.
He lived down in the area where they, when you go down by the creek and stuff like that. So he had a nice house back there, and he lived in, and everybody would call Poe Will to play weddings and all kind of stuff. And I used to sit down with Poe Will. He would sit there with his union drawers on and his boots and his mason jar of liquor. And the evening time, me and him would sit there, and he'd be showing me different things. And I, many evenings, I sit there with him when we didn't have to do nothing during the week. And I watched the sun go down, playing on the front porch of his house. And he would show me different old licks. Old time licks that, you know, and that he was doing from natural. I mean, this is just what he did, you know. I mean, he wasn't an educated person to do music other than the way he did it.
Hey, get up, brothers! Don't sit there with your head hanging down. Hey, get up, brothers! I know the ghetto have got you down, but there's something I want to say to you. Hey, get up, brothers! Do any dance that's groovy to you. Yeah, man!
Like many of his peers, Vincent never became a full-time musician. He worked as a longshoreman from the 60s until about 10 years ago, loading everything from baby food to bombs onto ships. At night, he performed with his band, the Top Notes. They played at nightclubs and social organizations, looking spiffy in their white tuxedos. They cut records, too. The Top Notes' biggest hit was the 1972 funk tune Dap Walk, once called an unhinged masterpiece of wah-wah guitar. Even today, Dap Walk remains a cult classic in Northern England. Vincent describes funk and the blues as close cousins.
You can't play funk without blues. That's right. Because you take blues and play it fast and break it up. Turn it into funk.
Hey, you brother over there! Come on, man, get out of your chair! And bring the fine sister with you, too! Get out on the floor and show me what you can do!
Vincent continues to play funk with a sound that's heavy on both horns and guitar. Lately, he's also been returning to his roots. His latest CD, Bayou Road Blues, is a tribute to the music of his early years, to the fish fries hosted by Curly and Marie, and to sunsets on Poe Will's Mississippi porch.
Mama, you don't have to hurry. Please take your time. Yeah, mama, you don't have to hurry. Lord, just please take your time. Yeah, cause the things that you find are a little deeper than the mine.
Coming up, the fight to save one of New Orleans' most famous neighborhood bars when we return to this radio special, Crescent City Blues. I'm Richard Ziegler. You're listening to Crescent City Blues. If you are within the sound of John T. Lewis's voice this Sunday evening, then you're probably standing within 5 feet of his band. Lewis is performing at the Mother-in-Law Lounge, perhaps the most iconic corner bar still open in New Orleans. The Mother-in-Law is located in Treme, across the street from an elevated highway. It's named after the 1961 rhythm and blues hit recorded by Ernie Cato, who owned the club with his wife, Antoinette, until he died in 2001. The Mother-in-Law is a monument to Cato, who wore a long mane and called himself the Emperor of the Universe. The walls are plastered with pictures and memorabilia. There's a life-size mannequin of the Emperor and an enormous replica of his head from a Mardi Gras float.
She worries me so.
Mother-in-law,
if she leave us alone, oh, we would have a happy home sent from down below.
Mother-in-law,
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 mother-in-law.
Betty Fox, Antoinette's daughter, grew up hearing mother-in-law but not knowing its singer. Fox remembers the first time she met her future stepfather. She had just gotten divorced and had moved back home to live with her mother.
I came home one day from work, and lo and behold, Ernie Cato was sitting in the kitchen. Well, I didn't know who Ernie Cato was, so he's in the kitchen and she's putting my dye in his hair. So my reaction is, are you using my dye for this man's hair? And immediately she just turns a whole nother color because I embarrassed her. She's like, do you know who that is? That's Ernie Cato. And I'm like, so? You know, I'm like, who was Ernie Cato? And, you know, she had to remind me that he was the man who sung Mother-in-Law. And I thought she was lying. I was like, you don't know anybody that famous. And I go in the kitchen. I was like, what's your name? And he said, I'm Ernest Cato. He didn't say Ernie Cato. I said, well, are you the man that sung the song my mom used to play all the time? And he says, yes. And I said, well, sing it for me. And he sings it. And he sings it, and I fall out like a little schoolgirl. I'm talking about screaming and yelling. Ah, it's you, it's you, it's you. She asks me what I made. You know, at that time, his career was on a downside. He had been drinking, and he came to stay with us. He had nowhere to go. And every morning, my mother was trying to get him to stop drinking. So every morning, he would sneak in the bathroom and drink a little vodka before my mom woke up, and I knew that that's what he was doing. And every morning before when I would pass him going, I would be going to work, and he'd be going in the bathroom, I would bribe him. And I told him I would not tell if you sing for me. And he would just sing anything for me, like the Star Spangled Banner. Because he always said that whenever the world comes to the end, it will always be two songs left. Mother-in-Law and the Star Spangled Banner. And then after a while, my mom would like try to get him gigs at different clubs. And I guess because he had been drinking and sometimes he wouldn't show up for gigs, people had stopped hiring him. So her thought was, well, I'll just open up my own bar. She just wanted somewhere where he can feel like a man, you know, that he has something to call his own. I don't want nobody. Talk about this little lady of mine.
This reason why. Enough. You can bet on that. I don't want nobody. Talk about this lady of mine.
Mm-hmm. From the day it opened in 1994, Mother-in-Law has been more than a corner bar. Its racially mixed clientele has included young hipsters, older R&B fans, and even celebrities like Fats Domino. Here's Rico Watts, who used to play keyboards for Cato.
And everybody's enjoying it, but a lot of time those high-priced artists, they like to just get away from the limelight a lot and just come back down to a little bar where they can buy a little drink and relax and don't have people worrying about autograph and that. Just get away from it, Walt. It was amazing that all those big-time artists who's making millions, I guess, a year would come into a small-time place like that, really, where the average Joe off the street can walk in for nothing, you know, and sit down and sit at the bar, elbow to elbow with a guy who's making millions, and here you probably come in a bar and you might be making $300 or $400 a week.
The musicians playing at Mother-in-Law were some of the same ones who had performed in New Orleans corner bars for decades. Ernie Vincent and the Top Notes were the opening act during the early years. The band's vocalist was Tommy Singleton, who remembers Cato's outsized personality.
When you went to the club, you know, the scenery was nice, and Ernie Cato was a good host, you know, and he get his head bad and he talks some trash now. But he was a good host. I mean, he wouldn't say anything that was going to insult you well. Run you away from the club, but he let you know that this was at Cato's house.
After Cato died in 2001, his widow Antoinette was determined to keep the bar open.
She did not want people to forget who Ernie Cato was. She did not want people to, 1 year down the line, forget that there was ever an emperor of the universe. You understand? And that is what she lived for. She lived to keep his name alive, not realizing that in that process of her keeping his legacy alive, she built her own.
Hurricane Katrina nearly destroyed the mother-in-law, which flooded to a depth of 7 feet. Antoinette stayed for the first week after the storm, trying to care for a disabled niece and protect the lounge.
And my mother can't swim. Can you imagine her saving all these pictures? She saved all these pictures before the water got too high. But when she came back, and I told her, I said, well, Mama, you know, I said, maybe you should think about, you know, doing something else, you know. You're 63 years old. Maybe you should think about doing something else. She said, no, there's nothing else for me to do. She said, I want to go back and be with Ernie. So, I mean, we just had to let her come back and do what she wanted to do. And she would be out there cooking for the policemen and the firemen. And, I mean, it's still water residing out of her place. And people came in from Hands On. The R&B singer Usher helped out. People from the Guiding Light came and helped out. And they renovated this place and got it back up and running.
Antoinette Cato died unexpectedly Mardi Gras morning 2009. Her daughter, Betty Fox, was living in Memphis. Fox didn't have her mother's experience running a bar, but she moved back to New Orleans and signed a new lease on the building.
When my mother passed away, it took a lot out of me emotionally. It's hard to follow in the footsteps of two people like that. She was just mama to us, you know what I mean? And she just became this really big person, you know, and it's because of the heart that she had. And that's what people remember. When they come here, they always know when they come that there's going to be red beans and rice. There's going to be something to eat. It's going to be gumbo or something to eat here. A lot of days that I'm in here and I'll cry because it's so emotional. It's a lot of tough days in here and I'm like, what am I gonna do? You know, people don't believe in spirits, and I didn't either until my mother passed, and I'm like, you can really feel that, and when you walk through the door, you can feel the love.
Some days, though, love isn't enough. More on that when we return with Crescent City Blues. I'm Richard Ziegler. The New Orleans music scene has never been static. One bar closes, another opens, the music goes on. Here's Ben Sandmel, a drummer and folklorist.
Somebody is always going to keep it going in some fashion. It's not going to be exactly like it was, and there are always different modern influences, and the music has to change or it'll get stagnant. It seems to me that this music is too good and it just has too much spirit. And there's too much of a community for it to disappear.
Still, New Orleans, battered by poverty and population loss, has had a tough time supporting its neighborhood bars. Guitar Joe's House of Blues, which opened in 1991, went on and off the market several times in 2010. By the summer of 2010, there's another complication, the BP oil spill, which closed seafood beds and damaged Louisiana's tourism industry. The impact on New Orleans' music scene is uneven, but where it hits hard. Take Tommy Singleton, whose job driving an oyster truck was dependent on the seafood beds. Here's his wife, Trina.
My husband worked with oysters, and due to the oil spill, we've been having very, very rough financial problems, and everything was behind in all of our bills. We still are struggling through the oil spill, and I would like to tell everybody that it reminded me of Katrina. It sent me back to that point to where, I mean, I'm really disgusted. I've been on the verge of nervous breakdown due to this. The little gig money is a little help, but it's not a big help because it just keep bread on the table, but it doesn't keep the bills paid. You know, and for this electric and water, the people doesn't care about that. If you don't have any money to pay the bills, they come turn your services off. We don't have anything. What are we going to do? We don't have no transportation. Due to financial-wise, we can't get the vehicle fixed because we have no money. So Tommy is like, when he have gigs, he's wondering, well, how I'm going to get there? You know, it's just very, very devastating. It's very hard for us. Everything is a battle. It's just my husband is 67 years old. I didn't want him to get in a depression stage or nothing like that, you know, and have a heart attack or anything worried about that. So I have to be strong to keep him going, you know. So that's what I'm really trying to do, keep Tommy strong so he can stay out here and sing. But it's very, very hard.
Singleton received no severance pay when he lost his job. He has not received unemployment compensation, nor has he received a penny from BP.
I can't believe you won't go. 'Cause your words say yes, baby. Your heart say no. Oh no, say no.
Across town, Betty Fox is worried too. Sitting inside the mother-in-law lounge, underneath the apartment she rents, Fox points to the front door of the building, boarded up with plywood after a freak accident.
This building has been hit 6 times by cars. That door got hit March the 1st at 8:06 a.m. and I was standing right in front of it. And the impact threw me and I fell and my kidneys are messed up and they swell up every couple of weeks where I have to go get this shot. Now, I can't make any money in the club because of the front door being broke. The rent here is $1,000, which the upstairs is not renovated. There's no plumbing. There's no electricity. There's ceilings falling in. It's termite damage. I haven't paid him rent because I haven't had any business. So 3 months, 4 months really now I'm behind. So he gives me a letter June the 9th, giving me 30 days to come up with $3,000. I mean, how can you expect me to make money when I don't even have a front door? People pass, they think I'm closed.
Fox says her lease requires her, not the landlord, to fix the door. In June, she said that was it. Flat broke, forced to work a second job, she decided to shut the mother-in-law after its 16-year run.
When somebody comes to you with a notice saying you have 30 days to come up with $3,000 and you have $12 in your purse, and $6 in your bank account, it's like my ends don't justify my means. I'm exhausted. I've cashed in my 401k. I've cashed in my stocks and bonds. You know, since I've been here, I've put all of my money into this business. I don't know how my mother did this.
Fox's announcement shook the musicians community, which has seen waves of loss over the last 5 years. The thought of New Orleans without the mother-in-law seemed impossible. John T. Lewis said if the bar closed, he'd be unable to drive the 1500 block of North Claiborne, just as he couldn't drive on his old street after Katrina. Here he is, along with Ben Samuel.
Man, they closed that place, man. I don't know what I'm going to do. It's going to be like losing oxygen, you know, because we need that place. You know, there's just so much love and stuff. Every time I've gone there,
You see, it's a certain thing. It's something that you don't get, that you may only get at home, in your own home. You know what I mean? Just like being at home at your own kitchen table, you know, eating a plate of red beans.
It's a really beloved place. It's like everybody's living room, everybody's favorite relative's house. And it would be a shame if a place with that much history that contributes that much to the community would be shut down because of some sort of financial problem that in the total scheme of things is really pretty small and should be able to be fixed easily and yet has not been fixed because people can't get together over, it's really nickel and dime stuff. It would be a huge loss for the community for it to go under, and especially in proportion to whatever amount of money is needed. It's not big money, but I mean the cost to the community if that place goes under would be way, way bigger than the cost of keeping it open monetarily.
The intensity of the grief caught Betty Fox off guard.
People were just calling. They were like, "Miss Betty, please, 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 this place means so much to us." You know, when I put the press release out on Facebook, it was a tremendous response. And just looking in people's faces, you know, that I mean, just the pain on their face knowing that this place was going to close, I just couldn't do it.
A few days after announcing the mother-in-law's closure, Fox sent out a text message to her customers. "I've decided to try and keep the lounge open," she wrote, "but I need the help and support of everyone in the community."
It's a long way back home. I surely hope that I can right my wrong. I never meant to do any harm. Oh Lord, I'm on my way back home. There's a lady way back there, Silver Spring in a hat. She's my mother, Lord knows I love her. I'm on my way back home.
That 11 nights later, the community did show its support. Hundreds turned up for a benefit at the mother-in-law. They spilled out of the side door into a yard that was lit with tiki torches and decorated with bathtub planters. It seemed like every musician in town was there.
In words clear and strong, that's why I'm on my way back home.
John T. Lewis opened with his rhythm and blues guitar. 4 hours later, Ernie Vincent and the Top Notes took the stage. As the evening unfolded, people kept arriving, paying enough $5 cover charges to restore Fox's confidence that her bar could be saved. The benefit didn't erase all of Fox's debt, but on this hot New Orleans night, there was reason for hope, just as the city needed it most. I'm Richard Ziegler.
A south wind spoke to me in words so clear and strong. I'm on my way back home.
Crescent City Blues was written and produced by Richard Ziegler and Barry Yeoman. The narration was recorded by Dave Tilley. Support for this project comes from Filmmakers Collaborative, with funding provided by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Special thanks to Ben Samuel, Michael Hurt, and Karen Leatham. This program is a part of a series called Still Singing the Blues. You can see photos, listen to more audio, and meet additional musicians at our website, stillsingingtheblues.org.